We started off by saying that we're relational creatures and we're impacted by the relational air we breathe. The atmosphere has a profound shaping of us. It's not the only thing, Charlotte Mason would argue. It's one of three things that shape us. Atmosphere, but then also the kinds of habits that have been intentionally and carefully formed. She says that habits are to life as rails are to a train. So just as a train runs on rails and the locomotive goes speeding down the way precisely as the rails guide it, same is true for us when it comes to habits. So what do we mean by habit? What is a habit? A habit is a propensity to respond to a given situation in a certain way. Obviously, the more deeply ingrained that habit is, the more consistent response. It can be as mundane as how I control the muscles of my arm and hand to lift a glass of water. I mean, that is a neuromuscular event. Certain brain cells fire, leading to nerves in the muscles of my arm and shoulder and hand, all of which guide me to pick up a glass and bring it to my lips that I might drink. Because it's habitual, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to tell my shoulder muscles to move forward, my arms to extend, my hands to wrap around the glass and carefully guide. All of that happens automatically because there is a neuromuscular habit that has been established long ago in my brain. Charlotte Mason was 100 years ahead of her time when it comes to her understanding of how the brain functions. She knew that when a habit was formed, there was a change in the very gray matter of the brain. We now know much more clearly how that happens. We know, in fact, that she's right. Every time we learn something new, a new neural network is laid down. We also know that the more you repeat an activity, in other words, the more a group of nerve cells fire together, the more frequently and easily they'll fire together. It's actually called Hebb's Law. Hebb was a neurologist, and his law is that brain cells, neurons, that fire together, wire together. That's the neurological basis for the formation of a habit. Every time I do something, a group of neurons line up and fire together in my brain. They do that once, they want to do it twice. They do it twice, it's easier to do it the third time. So we actually are in the process of getting a new brain every time we learn something. When it comes to the formation of habits, let's just move from something mundane like drinking a glass of water to something like being kind. There are children, you will notice, who general response is consistently kind. There are other children who are less than consistently kind. They've developed two different patterns, two different habits. In given context, they respond differently. The wonderful thing is that the brain is plastic, that we can learn new habits. In fact, that's the key. One of the things Charlotte Mason pondered as a young teacher was, how do we lift children above their nature? A class full of children come to a teacher, and the teacher notices one child tends to tell fibs, another is careless in work, a third has their attention adrifting. Do we ignore all that? Do we try to compensate for it? Or is there the possibility that the child who came to me and tells fibs now, is it possible that 9 months from now he would have a different habit? The child that does shoddy, careless work, is it possible 9, 10 months from now he would have the habit of doing neat and accurate work? The child that's consistently drifting in their attention, is it possible that 9, 10 months from now that child would have cultivated the habit of giving attention? And she answered yes. She said, in fact, we have one of two ways of looking at it. We can say that every child who comes to us has a certain nature. That nature is a propensity to act in a certain way. And there will be virtuous things and destructive things or less than helpful things about their nature. Are we confined to that? Do we abandon our children to their nature? Charlotte Mason bemoaned the fact that that seems to be what the majority of parents in her day and the great, great majority of teachers would tend to do. They tend to say, well, oh, he's just naturally messy. Or today we'd say, this child has an attention disorder, an attention deficit disorder. So we can't expect him to pay attention like the other students. It's interesting. We've had numerous children come to our school who would have met the diagnostic criteria for attention deficit disorder. And sometimes within a few months, sometimes within a couple of years, they became effectively non-diagnosable. Well, what happened? They learned a new habit. They learned the habit of giving focused attention and of holding that attention and the task at hand. This power of attention, this habit of giving focused attention, is arguably the most important habit of a student, because that which we give attention to, that we come to know. If we frame the power of attention as a habit, there's something we can do about it. If we frame it as a disorder, as a medical condition, then we and the child are stuck. We are victims of the child's neurobiology. I would argue that, yes, in fact, the child may come to school with a brain that it isn't well-tooled for giving attention, but it doesn't have to stay that way. In 9-10 months, the child will have a new brain. 9-10 months, you or I will have a new brain. Is it possible that that brain could now be a brain that has the power to give focused attention? We've seen that occur time and time and time again.
We're not trying to move in a behavioristic way in which we want children to behave in a certain way outwardly so that it's impressive or so that it looks good to themselves or their parents. But know that we're asking children to be involved in discipline of habit because it's a lever that will lift them up above themselves. It's going to be really freeing so that they can do the important work of knowing, and that they don't have to be worried about their mood, or they don't have to be worried about an indifference, or they don't have to be worried that they're going to be left alone and have to figure something out on their own and they don't know how to do something, or that when they have this indifference of not wanting to do something, they're going to be held accountable to actually do the work of a learner. And also, these ideas are present in the texts themselves. Rich, inviting texts that offer a world of information and ideas that are woven through literary language, through relationships. And these are the places in which we all, as persons who gather around these texts, we find great delight in sharing these with one another. And also just keeping these ideas in our own hearts, in our own minds, that are helping us to be more of a person.